Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The First Division, the Honorable Justice Michael B. Hyman presiding, case number 19-2519, People versus Victor Hudson.
Good afternoon. My name is Justice Michael B. Hyman. With me is Justice Relia Puchinski and Justice Mary Ellen Coghlan. We will conduct ourselves as if we were in the courtroom. That means that we will probably interrupt you and ask some questions. And if you would just finish your statement, if you can, if we don't ask you to stop, and then answer our questions, we'd appreciate it. Ms. Punjabi, you have time to reserve for a rebuttal. How much time do you wish to reserve? 20 minutes, each side has 20 minutes.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
Okay, thank you. Any questions before we begin?
Please
introduce yourself, Mr. Erb, just so on the record.
Sure. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Justin Erb, Assistant State's Attorney, and I'm here representing the state, the people of the state of Illinois.
Thank you. All right. May I proceed?
May it please the court. My name is Deepa Punjabi, and I represent the defendant appellant, Victor Hudson. Mr. Hudson appeals his conviction for armed habitual criminal in a case where a firearm that was found in a bedroom was attributed to him. At Mr. Hudson's trial, the jury appeared to struggle with the evidence, expressing doubt and confusion on key issues in their mid-deliberation question.
We're well aware of the fact. We've read all the briefs and read the record. So my question to you is, what is your strongest argument? You feel, and I mean, you may have a few, but which one, give me your top two. I mean, you can talk about all of them, but just start
sure.
with
sure. Sure. You know, they all kind of work together because okay. They all dealt with the jury being misled and misguided really at every turn. So I would say the jury question, particularly about the definition of knowledge and also the issue of the search warrant that Mr. Hudson was not allowed to elicit, that this search warrant was unrelated to his case. Given how thin the case evidence was, both of these constituted reversible error, I believe.
How was the search warrant related to his case other than explaining why the police were in the apartment or the house?
Well, the problem is, it was unrelated to his case, but the jury's question, the jury asked, why were the police there?
Juries often ask a lot of things, but unless there's a rule of law or some kind of precedent that the judge is gonna allow the evidence in or respond in a certain way, that's not a reason to allow evidence that would be otherwise inadmissible. But, you know, juries speculate all the time about things that, you know, understandably as a layperson, we can appreciate that they have questions, but as a matter of law, they're not going to get their answers because the judge is not allowed to do that.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand what you're saying.
So what I'm asking you is, under what rule of law would the judge have been authorized in putting substance of the search warrant in the case and making the jury aware of that? I mean, from my reading of the record, it appears to me that the only significance of this warrant is that it gives the police a reason to be in there, because clearly it had nothing to do with why the defendant was arrested.
The defense argued that this was admissible, the fact that the warrant was the contents of the warrant, the target of the warrant, was admissible under the course of investigation doctrine. And the scope of the course of investigation doctrine does encompass testimony regarding how and at what point or whether an accused is a suspect in a case. Now in Rivera, which is one of the cases that the trial court relied on, the appellate court there found that it was proper to allow the police to testify that they had a search warrant authorizing a search and targeting the defendant for the purpose of explaining the police conduct and investigatory procedure. And the appellate court explained in that case that the reason we allow this kind of testimony under the course of investigation doctrine is to prevent the fact finder from making any speculative negative inferences about the legality of the police conduct, to clarify that
I think we all know what the law is, but my question to you is, in this particular case, how does that apply? Because clearly, other than authorizing the police to be in the house, from my review of the record, that search warrant had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that the defendant was constructively charged with possessing a gun.
So, but the question the jury asked indicates that they were speculating that it did. They were trying to figure out how this warrant had, how that fit in the case against Mr. Hudson, and the defense was not actually seeking to prove that the police were in fact looking for Tommy Williams or were in fact searching for drugs. The defense was seeking to provide an accurate description of the investigation at that point as unrelated to Mr. Hudson or the gun, to prevent the jury from jumping to any conclusions about the warrant meant in what it meant in the case against Mr. Hudson. And they were entitled to do so under the course of investigation doctrine because it was offered for a non-hearsay purpose.
But what you're saying is it's not hearsay.
It's not hearsay.
Because it wasn't the truth of the matter that it was Tommy Williams in the drugs.
That's correct. And the problem, part of what heightened the prejudices here is that although the court allowed it in under the course of the existence of the warrant under the course of investigation doctrine, The no limiting instruction was ever issued to the jury, even after it was clear that the jury was ruminating on why they were told about the warrant and how did the warrant fit into the state's case against Mr. Hudson. The court did not at that point respond to tell them that the warrant was only to be considered for the limited purpose of describing the police's course of investigation and was not to be considered evidence of Mr. Hudson's guilt. So that only heightened the prejudice here in a case where the evidence was already very close. We know that the state's sole evidence here implicating Mr. Hudson was the unmemorialized statement he was supposed to have made, claiming ownership over the bedroom and the weapon, a statement Mr. Hudson denied making, and which for the state could offer no proof. While the state admitted into evidence two utility bills in Mr. Hudson's name, unlike the proof of residency offered by Mr. Hudson, the state's bills did not specify whether Mr. Hudson resided on the main level or the basement level. And on the other hand, Mr. Hudson provided positive evidence that specified he did not reside on the main level of the house. This evidence consisted of the testimony of multiple witnesses, several documents he admitted, one obtained in 2017 prior to the offense, the state ID, that were all addressed to Mr. Hudson at the basement level of the address. And the state was unable to rebut this evidence except with this alleged unmemorialized confession. And this is not a statement that was made under trustworthy conditions. The circumstances under which the police kind of ran roughshod over this family would have exerted a coercive pressure that would have undermined the reliability of the statement attributed to Mr. Hudson.
But the statement was given at the station, which a different place, a later time, things had calmed down, right? So how can the what happened at the home, you're saying, so how did that affect what happened at the station?
Well, it was a different location, but I think the statement was given quite shortly thereafter. All of this had just transpired. So I think he still would have, I think he even testified at there was something in his testimony at trial. Well, I had just been punched in the face by this officer.
He was punched in the face in his home when he came into the room with the police officers. And I don't know exactly how long it was till he was at a police station, but it was some time. It wasn't immediately. Some time passed before that occurred at the station, with that being the interrogation?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think the record is crystal clear on the timing, but I don't think it was a very long time afterwards. Well,
what do you mean by not a very, I mean, when you talk about time, not a long time can be minutes or hours, depending.
So. Sure, Your Honor. It certainly it would not have been just minutes after, but I'm not sure the record was clear on exactly how long a time had transpired. But I also think this court should ask itself, does it make sense that Mr. Hudson would have known he was in possession of something illegal nearby, yet did not hesitate to get into a confrontation with the police? Is that really conduct from which you can infer that he had knowledge of something illegal in his possession? Or does that constitute evidence that is so improbable or unsatisfactory as to constitute a reasonable doubt?
But aren't you asking us to speculate? I mean, isn't that pure speculation? Isn't that something for the jury to decide based upon the evidence?
Well, I think my brief does cite case law that says that you can infer knowledge based off the conduct of the defendant. And I think we really have to examine the defendant's conduct here and say, was the fact finder's conclusions here reasonable? And we don't even know that the jury was instructed properly. They seemed to not be clear on whether Mr. Hudson even needed to be aware of the gun to begin with, to be able to find him guilty. You know, they appeared confused in this case about the requisite mental state and asked multiple questions about what it meant to have knowledge for the purposes of proving possession. Specifically, the jury asked if Mr. Hudson was unaware of the gun in the closet, is he guilty of possessing it? The jury also asked, does Mr. Hudson have to have knowledge of the gun in order to have an intention to control the gun? And the jury appeared to be confused then about whether Mr. Hudson was required to be aware of the gun to meet the requisite mental state. Now, we know that in general, knowledge is the awareness of the existence of facts that make a defendant's conduct unlawful. And there is an IPI that states the same. IPI 5.01B, which is the standard instruction used to define the mental state of knowledge, states that knowledge of a material fact includes awareness of the substantial probability that such fact exists. So this instruction would have very simply answered the jury's question that yes, according to this instruction, Mr. Hudson would have to have had awareness of the substantial probability that the gun exists in the closet in order to have knowledge of it.
I'm confused by your argument because between B 5.01B and 5.01C. We know that 5.01C is the one the court gave, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And the B was. Now, which one of those puts the greater burden on the state?
Well, I know that the state argues that.
I'm not saying what is your, I'm asking from your point of view. I'm not asking for their argument. I'm asking which of those two puts a greater burden on the state? I mean, as a defense attorney, they're not the same.
They're not the same, I agree.
So there has to be a there's different reason and maybe a greater burden. When's a greater burden? Which one is a greater burden on the state?
I think under these facts, 5.01B, there's a good argument that might've been the harder burden to meet.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't understand when.
May I explain, Your Honor?
Yeah, please. Because direct and clear seems to me a lot tougher to show.
Under 5.01B, the standard definition of knowledge, it talks about knowledge of a fact includes a conscious awareness that the fact exists. And even under the statement the state alleges Mr. Hudson made, he says he had forgotten about the gun. Does that constitute a conscious awareness? So I'm not sure that 5.01B wouldn't have been the harder definition of knowledge to meet under these facts where he's saying that he forgot about the gun. That's not a conscious awareness. And the jury didn't even really get a chance to consider whether he had a conscious awareness of the gun under these facts.
Actual knowledge, wouldn't that be tougher? Because that's direct and clear knowledge? Direct and clear knowledge versus awareness of a substantial probability, which to me seems something less.
I think the problem with 5.01c is that it's not helpful to the jury's questions. It's defined rather unhelpfully in this context. Knowledge is direct and clear knowledge. Knowledge that would lead a person to inquire further. I'm not sure what that means in this context. It's not responsive to the jury's question about what kind of awareness Mr. Hudson needed to have to be considered to have knowledge of the gun. It's 5.01b that speaks to what kind of awareness, and that's would have been more responsive to the jury's specific question in this case. You know, our Supreme Court has held that a court's response to a jury's question has to provide clarification with accuracy and specificity. And here it's 5.01b that more specifically would have addressed the jury's question about what level of awareness was required, because it talks about awareness and a conscious awareness and what kind of awareness is needed to meet the mental state of knowledge. And so it was error not to provide this instruction, because there is a real possibility here, as I see it, that the jury convicted Mr. Hudson without clearly understanding that he was required to have awareness of the gun to be convicted of possessing it. Were there any other questions that I could answer for
any
this
other
court?
Questions? Hearing none, you wanna?
For those reasons, I'd ask that this court either reverse his conviction outright or reverse and remand for a new trial.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Erb?
Good afternoon. My name again is Assistant State's Attorney Justin Erb, and I'm here representing the people of the state of Illinois. May it please the court. Beginning with defendant's argument that the people failed to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, this argument is meritless and should be rejected by this court. The people provided ample evidence that defendant resided in the third bedroom, either primarily or at least frequently enough that he would know that there was a firearm in his closet.
Ample evidence? I don't see ample evidence here when you have bills from the basement. We have people testifying about the basement. You say ample, they say it's close. Big difference between close and ample. And in this case, it seems to me that close is more accurate in light of what was presented to the jury. Why would you say ample?
Your Honor, to clarify the people's position, there was certainly conflicting evidence in this case. There was the evidence, as Your Honor pointed out, that there were bills, or I apologize, not bills. There were ID cards showing that he lived in the basement. There were testimony from both defendant and his family that he lived in the basement. But there was also ample evidence, to use my own term, on the other side that he did, in fact, live in the bedroom.
Both of them are ample evidence. So, I mean, if you're going to have it that way and say your side, the bedroom is ample, but the other isn't, I think we could use the word ample for both, which makes it a close case. I mean, you have the ID, voter registration versus some bills. Bills usually come to a house. I don't know if there were separate bills for his basement versus the rest of the house, but in any event, it went to the house and they had his name on it.
Your Honor, it wasn't simply just the bills. There were also the fact that defendant had medication for his gout condition in the bedroom, and there was also a confession.
It's all circumstantial evidence. People have bills. People can have pills anywhere in the house. That doesn't prove that somebody, and you know that, even with the other evidence, does not establish that was his residence. That was he in and out of the... Was it possible he was in and out of that room? Yeah, possible. But that it's residence? Does that mean somebody resides in the bathroom because their pills are in the bathroom? Of course not. So it doesn't matter where you get pills. People have pills all over the place.
Well, Your Honor, to briefly respond, it would be unusual to, at least in the people's position, it would be unusual to keep one's pills in another person's bedroom. But regardless, the people agree that this wasn't a case that was completely overwhelmingly one-sided. This was a case with conflicting evidence. This was certainly a case where the jury had to make a credibility determination. And in this case, the jury did make a credibility determination. It weighed the evidence and found that despite the conflicting evidence, that the people proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And to note quickly, the jury seemed to not find this case particularly close struggle to find that the people met their burden in this case. They sent a note to the court after saying that the law was clear and the evidence was sufficient. However, they found that the circumstances of his arrest were unfair and asked that the court take that into consideration during cert.
I think that's just you're just focusing on a couple. There were four inquiries, all different. You're focusing on a couple, but it's broader than that. And I think that raises a whole question of which I think you're getting to with regard to the warrant, because that's a very important part of all this, is their concern about what was going on here.
Well, Your Honor, getting to the search warrant, the jury did ask the question where the warrant went to, whether defendant was the subject of warrant, and the court gave the very reasonable and correct instruction that that's not in evidence and it shouldn't be considered by them.
Is it hearsay?
Your Honor, it's not here. Let me back up. The fact that there was a warrant, the fact that a warrant existed, and the fact that the police were there to serve a warrant was not hearsay. That is simply course of conduct, and it's not there to prove the truth of the matter asserted. The purpose for that testimony was to simply put the people's case in context and to give a reason for what the police were doing at that address at that time. To get into more information about that, such as whether or not the defendant was the subject of the warrant and what specifically the police were looking for, is that's when it, as the court correctly found, that's when it starts getting at the hearsay.
Let's analyze it. That's whether it's correct or not, that's hearsay. As I discussed with counsel for the defendant, the truth of the matter asserted is not shown. That is that Williams had drugs in that house. Whether Williams was in the house, he wasn't in the house. Had to do with Williams, and it was about drugs, not about guns. In this case, under these facts, isn't there a big mystery there? And actually, the jury very sharply understood that there's a mystery here, and that's why they inquired about it. What are they doing here? You know, what's going on here? When police burst in like this, and so this situation happened, there is a reason. And if there's no explanation other than say there's a warrant, what would a reasonable person conclude? Tell me, what you think a reasonable person would conclude that the warrant had nothing to do with anybody at the house? Is that reasonable?
I think a reasonable person would conclude that there was a search warrant for that house. As to the facts of
this. For that house, as to what? To a gun. This case is all about a gun. That's the only thing they hear about gun. They don't hear anything about drugs. So what are they supposed to think? All they hear about is Hudson and drugs. Hudson and drugs. And the warrant had nothing to do. They weren't there because of Hudson and drugs. I mean, Hudson and guns. That's why they brought them there. So doesn't that give a false impression? It's as if the jury doesn't think. I mean, we know here we have a thinking jury. They were concerned about this, and it left a gap in their understanding of what was going on. So that what would the conclusion of a reasonable person be in that situation? That they were looking for the mother? Would that be reasonable? Would they be looking for the son? What they were looking for? They were looking for medicine, or they were looking for stolen televisions. I mean, the evidence was about guns.
Your Honor, to begin, even if the jury would conclude that there was a search warrant, and given the absence of evidence and given what we've heard, clearly the search warrant must have been for the defendant. and it must have been for a gun. To begin, contrary to what defendant argued, the court did give a limiting instruction there. The court instructed them that that fact isn't in evidence, shouldn't be considered by you as to what the search warrant was about. Second, that would have no bearing on the decision of whether or not he's actually guilty of the crime. Whether or not the warrant was for him or was for somebody else or any one of if memory serves, 5 or 6 people who were at the house at that time, that would have no bearing on the question of whether or not that bedroom was defendant's bedroom, whether the police were telling the truth when defendant confessed that it was his bedroom, and whether he knew that there was a gun in that closet. If there's no further questions on this subject, we can move to the knowledge instruction. Okay. Your Honor, as Your Honor noted during the previous argument, there's really no question that the answer to what is knowledge in this context of actual knowledge is far more restrictive and to the point in this case than to give the instruction for constructive knowledge or willful knowledge. The operative difference here between the two cases is that actual knowledge is defined very simply, very bluntly, straightforward. Knowledge is knowledge. It's direct knowledge. It's he knew that there was a gun in that closet. On the contrary, the preferred instruction by defendant would be that he was consciously aware that his conduct is of that nature or that those circumstances exist or if there's a strong probability of that. If the facts of this case did not lend to that instruction, there was no question about whether defendant had a knowledge of a strong possibility of the gun existing in the bedroom. It's simply, did he know that the gun was in the bedroom? Considering the evidence that was actually brought out in this case and the people's arguments, this instruction was far more simple, far more direct, and far more on point than the other instruction.
Well, you make a very interesting point. I appreciate it too. The fact that C is simpler than B.
In this context.
Huh?
In the context of this case.
Well, I think in any context. I think when you read it, it's so much easier to understand actual knowledge definition. It's a very simple statement.
Yes, sir.
The other instruction of constructive knowledge is not as easy for lawyers, let alone lay people, to understand because the language is more complicated. It's more dense. It's longer. And it takes a lot more thinking to figure out what the heck that is. So there could be certain advantages that could mirror to the fact of using a simple instruction. You know, it's not the fault of the judge that the instructions, one is written simply and the other is more complex, but it might go the way a jury would understand. And people's minds usually try to look for the most, the easiest thing to understand. I mean, that's how our minds work. If it's more complicated, they seem to gravitate towards the easy. That's why lawyers like to make easy arguments. The more complex takes more work to try to get there. So I think that's a good point.
Thank you. Now, I would also like to just briefly note on the knowledge that going back to the jury's question, there's a implication that the jury had been confused during their deliberation. I believe that an examination of the questions and certainly the note at the end would show anything but as I said before, the jury note said we did not come by this decision easily, although the law is clear and the evidence is sufficient, the circumstances for Victor are unfair. This would indicate to a reasonable person, it's the people's position at least, that the jury didn't want to find defendant guilty and they were looking for ways to try to understand the law such as a way that he could get out of this unfair situation and could not, because they, as the jury said, the law is clear and the evidence is sufficient and they did not come easily by this decision, but nevertheless they did. And if there are no questions on the final topic, which was the question of the gun registration instruction, then the people would simply ask that this court affirm defendant's conviction.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. The state urges that the evidence was ample. I think actually the jury's note reflected the weakness of the evidence. It's that unusual statement of reservation accompanying the jury's verdict actually stated our deliberations were difficult. This was not easy for us. And so this was not an ample, strong, overwhelming case. Appellant maintains that the evidence here was not sufficient, but even if this court finds that the weaknesses in the state don't merit outright reversal, this court should find at a minimum that it rendered the other errors here to be reversible error, particularly this issue with the search warrant. You know, defense counsel sought evidence that fell properly within the course of investigation conduct doctrine, testimony describing the investigation, and they sought it for a non-hearsay purpose. It was wrongly denied. What defense counsel was asking for here actually fits very neatly within the established purpose of the police course of investigation doctrine, which in Rivera, this court explained, is to provide a complete enough description about the police investigation in such a way as to prevent any misleading inferences that might arise, which is what occurred here, which is why the defense wanted to prevent any speculation that this warrant somehow was evidence of Mr. Hudson's guilt. And again, you know, the state says there was a limiting instruction, but they were not told that this was only to be considered for the limited purpose of describing the police course of investigation and was not to be considered as evidence of Mr. Hudson's guilt. And this was particularly dangerous in a case where the state's evidence against Mr. Hudson was so weak and so thin.
What about
because the jury may have filled in. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what about the fact that to the jury's mind, this is a case that had to do with a gun, not with drugs, correct? In the jury's mind.
That's correct.
Okay. So if it has to do with guns, considering what happened when the police entered and they had an altercation, I'll call it, which is a euphemism for what happened to the son. And then when his father comes in the room, the defendant, another physical confrontation. Now, if you're looking for a gun, that's serious stuff. As opposed, if it's drugs, nothing about a gun, then maybe, you know, you wouldn't expect police to do that normally, to act that way, which may have led to some of the.
That's correct.
Isn't the fact that this is a case about a gun is aggravated by what preceded it, which makes the nature of the search warrant even more important to disclose.
I agree, Your Honor. It only would have inured more to the defendant's, it would have been at more hold adverse on. To the defendant.
We lost your opponent.
Uh-oh.
Oh, wait, okay.
I apologize. I was just taking a sip of water. I didn't want to be.
Oh, okay. I don't want you to miss anything. All right, I apologize for interrupting, but I didn't want to
miss your argument. So, Your Honor, that's correct. And so because of how this transpired, this only would have caused the jury to engage in speculation that negative speculation potentially against the my client. And this, you already have a case where the evidence is pretty weak and thin. And so the jury may have filled in the gaps in the state's case with these inaccurate speculative inferences that the warrant somehow meant that they were looking for Mr. Hudson, and this was evidence somehow of his guilt.
Well, if you were going to do that, then aren't you relying on the truth? Oh, this they're not looking for guns; they're looking for drugs. I mean, isn't the only value of that the truth of what's in the warrant?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The defense was not actually seeking to prove that the police were in fact looking for drugs or in fact looking for Tommy Williams or John Smith or whoever. The defense was seeking to provide an accurate description of the warrant and investigation at that point as unrelated to Mr. Hudson or the gun, so as to prevent the jury from jumping to any conclusions about the warrant, what the warrant meant in the case against Mr. Hudson, just as the
I understand what you're arguing, but what I'm trying to figure out is what case supports admitting the substance of a search warrant for that purpose?
Well, there were cases because on both sides.
You do concede, I assume, that the substance of the warrant had absolutely nothing to do with the charge in this case of armed habitual criminal or anything to do with a gun.
It only had to do with preventing the jury from making a misleading inference. It was the defense sought this information just as the state seeks to, under the course of investigation doctrine, to enter the existence of the warrant. So as in this case, this court described in Rivera, so as to prevent fact finder from jumping to any conclusions about the legality of the conduct. Here, this was sought to provide accurate description of the investigation so as to prevent the fact finder from making any misleading inferences about or jumping to any conclusions about what this warrant meant in the case against Mr. Hudson.
But in this case, that had absolutely nothing to do with the crime charged.
But the jury thought it might have, and the whole point is to provide a complete enough description so as to of the investigation so as to prevent those kinds of misleading, of misleading speculation.
And what case do you, what is your best case for your argument that if the jury is confused about the charges pending against the defendant, then the contents of the warrant come in?
I think the jury's question surely shows that they were trying to divine the relation of the warrant against in the case against Mr. Hudson, to see how it fit in. Was it evidence against Mr. Hudson? As far as a specific case, you know, these are unusual circumstances because usually it's the state who's trying to get evidence in under the course of investigation doctrine. And that's usually the case.
You don't notice that in reading all these cases.
That's right. Exactly. And so it was difficult.
I think there's a good reason for that.
But and this is unusual because the defense is trying to get evidence in under this doctrine. But listen, the doctrine should apply impartially to both sides. You know, and I know this is unusual because it's the defense side that's trying to get evidence in under this doctrine, but
well,
it should apply with equal
force. In my view, is that it has nothing to do with the charges against the defendant. That's what I consider to be unusual.
I understand what you're saying, Justice Coghlan. The purpose of getting evidence in under this doctrine, though, is to prevent the kind of speculation that it seems that the jury did end up engaging in. You know, the defense counsel saw this coming and tried to head it off at the pass by filing this motion in limine. And when the court denied it, prejudice did accrue as evidenced by the jury's questions. Their wheels started turning. How was this evidence against Mr. Hudson? What was this warrant about? And, you know, even at that point, there was a chance to mitigate the prejudice by at least instructing them that the warrant evidence was not to be considered as substantive evidence of Mr. Hudson's guilt and should only be considered for the limited
purpose. What if there hadn't been any questions? What would your argument be then?
I would say that it still would have been error to deny this evidence that was sought for a non-hearsay purpose and did fit under this doctrine. But I think the question certainly shows that the prejudice that defense was trying to prevent did occur here. Were there any other questions I could answer for the court?
No, if you please conclude.
Well, in that case, I would respectfully ask that this court reverse Mr. Hudson's conviction outright or reverse and remand for a new trial.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both of you for excellent briefs and excellent argument this afternoon. Appreciate your professionalism and your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and hopefully it will be forthcoming. And we will be in recess. And I thank everyone very much. Have a good afternoon.